Mr. Holland has been teaching music at Kennedy High School for 30 years, but the music is about to stop. The funding for the music program has been cut, axed for budget reasons. Mr. Holland, they're going to force him to retire. And I don't blame him. He's feeling a little sorry for himself. After all, he never really wanted to be a teacher. But now, all he wants to do is keep teaching. He's looking back and wondering, where did the time go? Thinking about, well, what do I do next? What happened to all of that great music I was going to write? Enter the community. The people Mr. Holland impacted wanted him to see the difference that he made. So they gathered together to do something very special. And in comes Little Miss Play the Sunset herself, Gertrude Lang. She's no longer the scrawny, awkward, red-haired teenager. Nope, she's governor of the state. She reminds him that his greatness is not the music he wrote, but the lives he changed. Her speech is heartfelt, and it's very moving. But it's not as moving as what they had planned next. You see, Mr. Holland, he has spent his entire life teaching music. But he'd also spent it writing a symphony that had never been played. Now, I don't know how, but somehow they got a hold of his music. Wives, what are you going to do with them? And behind that curtain, prepped to play the music that he wrote, is a band, an orchestra. Not an orchestra composed of professional musicians, but one that is going to be a conglomerate of all of the students that he had impacted over his entire life. And they're going to call Mr. Holland to the stage to conduct one more performance. And I have to wonder, what's the biggest thrill? Finally hearing the music? Or seeing and hearing his musicians? What a moment. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and the many wonders and signs were performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes. They ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying favor of all people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. We read these verses, and like Gertrude's speech, it's kind of inspiring to think about what that must have looked like. Unfortunately, for some reason, the song never seems to come because for some reason we can't get the band together. And inside of me, I know what the issue is. And it kind of starts here. You see, we, and please notice I am using that word, we have made this all about us because that's really what I devote myself to. I spend a lot of time working on me. You know, whether it's exercise or eating or entertaining or whatever, I spend a lot of my life devoted to me. And unfortunately, it spills into this church thing, and we've made prayer about asking stuff for me. A lot of my prayer life is spent that way. God, I need this, or God, I need that, or God, I want this, or God, I want that. We've made worship into entertain me. Do what I like done so that I get something out of it. We've made fellowship into food for me. Okay? And even when it comes to the Bible, we have made teaching into just the rules for me to live by. And when we do that, the church does not, I mean, the world does not hear a beautiful medley of Jesus. You know what they hear? Loud, angry noise. That's hard, isn't it? Because when they hear the loud, angry noise, then we don't get to hear the very last note that came from Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. Enjoying favor with all people. Do you get what that's saying? These people were living in a society that did not hold them in high esteem. They had crucified Jesus for claiming to be Messiah, and now all of a sudden, these people are finding favor with all people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. So they were growing on a daily basis, people that were giving their life to Christ. Isn't that what we want? When we sit here on Sunday mornings, when we get together and we come together as a church, isn't this what we're supposed to be focused on? And that brings us to a really interesting question. Do numbers matter? And immediately I want to be the good little church person. Numbers do not matter. Okay, let's take a little test. How many men did Jesus feed with those loaves of fish and bread? How many? How many people were baptized at Pentecost? 3,000. Why do we know those numbers? Because they're in the Bible. Duh. They're there. So if numbers don't matter at all, then why didn't they just say Jesus fed a bunch of people? Why not just say a lot of people came forward and got baptized? Why put the numbers there? Because here we are 2,000 years later, and you know what would happen if they put a lot or many. We'd be sitting around here debating and parsing how many a lot or many are. All right, so they solved the problem. They said, look, this is how many, because in one sense of the word, numbers do matter. Matthew chapter 25, Jesus talks about faithful servants, and like it or not, it's all about the numbers. Remember, he gave 10, 5, and 1, and he gave 5, 3, 1, sorry. And he expected you to increase the numbers, and those that invested what they were given and increased their numbers, he patted them on the head and said, well done, my good and faithful servant. And the person that took their number and went and buried it, even though they returned the number they had gotten, Jesus looked at them and said, wicked servant, you should have at least put it at the bank, especially nowadays. Banks are giving pretty good interest rates these days. You could have at least earned some kind of interest for me. Do numbers matter? Well, now, it can't just all be about numbers. I joked with the elders one time, and the offer's still open. You give me 6 months, I'll fill this sanctuary. You may not like the way I do it, but I can fill it. Okay? But here's the thing. If I have to fill the sanctuary by cheapening the gospel, that's not acceptable. So numbers at the expense of what our mission is, which is to share the gospel, those are not the numbers we want. But I do want to tell you something. Read through the book of Acts. Everywhere the gospel was preached, numbers followed. Now that does not mean that every church is called to be a great big mega church. But you know what it does mean? Even a small fellowship of believers has a very big responsibility. And that brings us to our message today. Today we're going to close up this sermon series with Mr. Holland talking about diving into discipleship. And it starts with a confession. I messed up. Seriously, how many people here today know what this picture is, raise your hand. Yeah. I messed up. It's been way too long since you've seen it on screen. This is a model for making a disciple. It's missing its words, but we're going to put the words back on it here in just a few moments. And the thing is, this is one of those weird things that I brought over the mountain with me. Okay, it came with me from Charlottesville. And by the way, it came to Charlottesville from Lynchburg. This little model has followed me everywhere I've gone because I believe in this model. But nowadays, it's kind of found its home on our website and in our welcome packet. And, well, it's kind of just fallen by the wayside. And that's my fault. I don't get to blame COVID. I don't get to say, well, so-and-so this or so-and-so that. It's my fault because I allowed myself to get distracted. And I noticed as I looked back across the numbers over the years, the further we moved from this model, the more sporadic our numbers came. Therefore, it's time to get back to the basics. So we're going to talk about discipleship this morning, and we're going to fill in those blanks. Eventually, first we have to put some terms out there. What is a disciple? So good old Webster's Dictionary, all right? A follower or a student of a teacher, leader, or philosopher. Wait a minute. That's part one of the definition. Did you know that if you go look this word up in the dictionary, there's a part two to what a disciple is? The other part that you have to have if you're going to be a true disciple, one who accepts and assists in spreading the doctrines of another. You catch that? It isn't enough that you're following. It isn't enough that you're believing. It isn't enough that you're accepting. If you're a true disciple, you take on the responsibility of assisting to spread the doctrine of the person you say you're following. That is a disciple. Therefore, the synonyms you get are followers, which may apply to people who attach themselves either to the person or the beliefs of another. You get words like adherent, suggest a close, persistent attachment. You get a word like partisan, which suggests zealous, often prejudiced attachment. Do you see the word there? If you're a disciple, what are you? You are attached to the person you were following. There's this old study that they used to do at the church I came from. It was called The Dust of the Rabbi. And it talked about how his disciples followed him so closely that the dust from his feet would settle on their feet behind him because they followed Jesus. They were attached at the hip. How often did you ever see Jesus without his disciples? And how often did you see the disciples without Jesus? There was an attachment that goes along with this idea of being a disciple. So with that in mind, what is discipleship? Well, again, nothing fancy here. Pulled this right out the dictionary. A condition or situation of being discipled, a follower, or a student of some philosopher. And this definition caused me to go, because it's a condition. Maybe I can get over it. I'm sure they probably sell something down at CBS that'll help me out with this, right? It's a condition. It called it a situation. Maybe this is something I can work my way through. You know, I can learn enough ins and outs and I can navigate my way through this discipleship situation. Here's the thing. This definition makes it all about the person being discipled. Isn't that what it says? It says being a disciple. But as you look this word up in the dictionary, you know, I found the most interesting thing that I never really paid attention to before. This is why you buy dictionaries, folks. It's a noun, a person, place, or thing, According to the dictionary, it's a noun. It's a thing that I can acquire. It's a thing that I can have. It's a possession. It's an object. However, there's somebody that disagrees with them about whether or not it's a noun. His name is Jesus. Because Jesus says discipleship is a verb. It is all about actions. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always, even to the very end of the age. So this morning we're going to pull at this little verse a little bit. At the same time, we're going to go back and we're going to fill in our little fill-in-the-blank object lesson so that we understand the model that we, the church, are supposed to be following on how do I do discipleship. Because I think we've got it upside down. So the first thing in there, I like this. Take out the word therefore, which, by the way, anytime you see the word therefore in the Bible, you know what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to find out what it's there for. That means stop, pay attention, dissect this, look at it. Therefore, and then what's the very next word? The very first action.
Go.
Go. It's about the community, and I'm not talking about the community in the building. I'm talking about the community outside the building. It is about go. And, of course, the first question I have to ask is, where are we supposed to be going? Well, Jesus says in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, excuse me, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, and in Judea, and in Samaria, and even to the ends of the earth. Excuse me just a minute. There we go. Something went down the wrong way. All right. Even to the end of the earth. So the answer is, where are we supposed to go? Everywhere, anywhere, and everywhere. I promise you, I'm not sick. I have allergy issues. I've been bad them all week long. Okay. Anywhere and everywhere. But it says, start in Jerusalem. Your community. He didn't say, hey, get in it and drive off to the other side of the world. Where do you say start? Your own back door. Right here in your community. And you know, that is kind of what you're seeing when you get to the idea of the church in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. They are building a community of believers in the community they live. Are you paying really close attention to that? When you look at it, it does not say they got together and they came up with ideas about how to go out and reach people. It just says they got together and the community that they were building, it attracted others to them. That's amazing. That's the first thing you notice in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. There's no outreach program because they were the outreach, because that's what discipleship is. If we have no community amongst ourselves, then we have no community to offer to others. Again, let that roll through your brain. If there's no community inside this building, then if I go outside the building to invite people to come and experience Jesus, then what do they get to come experience if there's no community for them to come in and experience? Well, what they're going to experience is come and sit in a seat, don't wiggle too much. By the way, I'd like to commend Rich for his statement. I'd like to also remind you guys, your minister is a former them kid. All right? If you don't know what a them kid is, yeah, you know what a them kid is, right? I was one of them kids that people were like, gee, way too much energy for my taste and way too much imagination and way too much free time on my hands. Okay? So I was a them kid, and it was some little lady that decided, you really need to go to church. And she took me to her church, and that's where this all started when I was little. But I was a them kid. So I can respect the fact that when you come to church, sometimes as a kid, you don't know how to sit still. Because I still don't know how to sit still. All right. Anyway, all right. So if you have no community to offer others, then what are you going to do with it? You see, the less community we have in the church, the less likely we are to reach out to others. If we're just people sitting in a building on Sunday morning, then you know what? I come and I do my time on Sunday morning, and then I go home. And then what do I need else to do? I did my time. I checked my box for this week, right? But if I'm actually building community to ask people to come to my community, then that means we actually have to build community. That's the reason we were here Friday night playing games. It wasn't so that we could just have fun playing games, because I learned a lot about people that week. I learned a lot about Bryson. Bryson and I spent a lot of time together, and it was kind of a cool night for me. Thus, if we're going to fix our reach in the outside community, we must first focus on the inside community. We have to learn to build the community inside of our church to create a nice little landing spot for those that are coming. So, okay, we got the community. We went. We got people coming. They're walking through our door. Maybe we'll get to the point where we can't beat them off with a stick. Everybody wants to come. Everybody wants to have a seat. What am I supposed to do with them after they get here? Well, that's not hard. Jesus says that, right? We're supposed to make disciples. One of those says, he did not say, go into all the world and make you a disciple. What did he say? Make disciples. That means it's plural. That means more than one. That means multiple. And so Jesus is not talking about going out and getting one person to follow you so that you can teach them to follow him. You're supposed to be getting a crowd together. Notice he does say make and not create. See, when you create, you're making something from nothing. That's what God did at the beginning of the universe. When he said, let there be, there was nothing there. He said, now be something. So when you create, you're starting from nothing. Creating means you decide what goes in and what does not. Creating means I have a general idea of what I want, but really the finished product is up for debate. When I am trying to create something, you know when I'm finished? When I say I'm finished. When I look at it and say, that's good enough. Yeah, that's about what I had in mind. If you're making something, that's a little bit different. You see, to make something, you need two things. You need some raw materials, and then you know what else you need? You got to have some instructions on how to make it. You ever bought one of the pieces of furniture from Walmart you're supposed to put together, and you drag it all the way home, and you open the box, and they left the instructions out? And all you got is a bunch of pieces laying all over your living room, and you have no idea how to put that thing together? You know, the funny thing is, when I do marriage counseling, the very first marriage lesson I do is I go out and buy a box of Legos, so it's a little Lego model, and I bring it to the very first marriage counseling, but before they get there, I slip the box open, remove the instructions, then I hand them and say, now, you've got the picture, build it without the instructions. And I give them about 20 minutes, and sometimes they get close, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes they laugh about it, and sometimes it's not a very pretty picture at all. Sometimes, you know, it tells you a lot about the relationship as they're trying to build this Lego model with no instruction, because really to make it, you have to have two things. And you're done when you have all the pieces and they are all assembled correctly and yours looks like theirs. That's how I know I got the Lego finished, right? I got the model finished when I pull out the instructions and I've gone through all the pieces. Mine looks like theirs, and when I'm all done, there's no pieces left laying on the table. If I got pieces left over, that means either they made a mistake and they put too many pieces in the box, or I made a mistake and I left something out. We're supposed to be making disciples. Now, the good news is, we have the instructions. We don't have to go find new instructions on how to make a disciple. We can blend Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47, with Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 through 19, and we know exactly what needs to be done. Thus, we don't need to write a new recipe on how to make and grow a disciple. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But we do need to gather together some raw materials. People that are not disciples. I have a newsflash for you. You cannot make a disciple from a disciple. Let me say that again. You cannot make a disciple from a disciple. If you've already got somebody that's accepted Christ as their personal Lord and Savior, you can grow and develop them, but you cannot make a new disciple from an existing disciple. Okay, that's like trying to make a gingerbread cookie out of a cookie that's already been baked. It doesn't work. It crumbles all apart. You have to, what do you have to do? You have to go get some fresh material, some people that aren't disciples, so that you can then disciple them. That's the way it's supposed to work. You can't make a disciple from a disciple. You have to go get some new material. That means we've got to always have this idea that we should be looking to bring people into the church. Not so that we can fill the pews, but so that we can help them understand what it means to follow Jesus. And that's the next step in our little diagram. See, we start out in the community, just out there with the people. We try to gather ourselves a crowd of people that aren't already disciples. And now it's our responsibility to teach them how to make a connection to Christ. Jesus made this real simple. He summarized that entire connection in one word. Baptize. Now, understand, that's kind of like the ending step we're going to talk about. But if I am going to have somebody connect to Christ, the very first thing I have to do is share Jesus. Now, that just means I need to tell people who he is. Maybe I'm really good at this and I tell people what he did historically. But it also means I have to be willing to tell them what he did for me personally. See, if all I can give you is the facts about who he was and what he did, and I can read you some Bible verses, you don't make much of a connection. The connection comes when I'm able to tell you what he does in my life. Okay? It's because that is what it's all about. You do not need to tell all the facts. We think people think you have to have a college degree these days to tell somebody about Jesus. You don't have to tell them everything. Okay, especially not in the first city, and that's a really bad idea. Okay? You don't have to tell them everything, but you do have to be able to share some basics about him. He came. He's God's son. He lived a sinless life. He gave his life on the cross. They placed him in a tomb. And that he rose from the grave. And I'm betting if you've come to church for a while, I haven't just told you anything new. You know all of those facts. But not only do you have to share Jesus, they actually have to see the working model. They've got to see the finished Lego set all put together. And unfortunately, the best example they've got is us. So they've got to be able to look at my life and see that I actually am a disciple, that I have been made. And then we wanted him to connect personally. See, at some point there's got to be some passing of batons, and this is what we've missed with our kids a lot of times. A lot of times with our kids, we teach them all the facts and we share all the information, and somehow we never take our faith and allow them to make it their faith. They're still living our faith even when they become adults. At some point, that don't work, okay? They've got to make it their faith. They take the baton. It becomes a personal thing, and that, my friends, is where baptism comes in. So you guys have watched me do this demo more often than not. Since I have nobody that wants to come up to the one to be my personal representation, we'll just have to do the show for you. So here we go. So when you baptize somebody, they already have an understanding of who Jesus is. They're already willing to say, I want to be a follower. This is like that moment that they're getting all nice and tuned in. And so they step into the baptismal and they're standing this way and the water is going this way. And what do you have? A cross. This is an interactive lesson, by the way. You have to talk. You have a cross. All right. So then we say some words and then we take them and we put them down under the water. And what do we have? It's a burial. Okay. You are buried with Christ in baptism. And you know what the really good news is we don't leave them here. This would be a bad idea, okay? We would never have a new church member. We would drown them, okay? So what we do is we pull them out of the water, and what are we representing? The resurrection. You see what baptism really is? It is an identification with the death, burial, and resurrection of who Jesus is. It is the connecting point for somebody that seeks to be a follower to say, sign me up, I'm in. And I want the world to know. That is why it is a public demonstration of your confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and you're accepting Him as your Savior, and you are following Him as your Lord, and then we step into that baptismal, and we do the connection. You are reenacting what you say you are now accepting in your life. Now here's the warning label. We misconstrue Jesus' verses, and we're trying to teach them to try to obey minus the Jesus part first. If you're dealing with somebody that is not a disciple, you don't need to teach them all the different ways they're a bad person. Okay? That's not a good idea. And you also don't need to teach them all the theology that we love to do as church people. Just keep it simple, folks. This is about Jesus. And then once they accept Christ, once they've signed up to be a follower, now you get to go to the next step and you get them to commit. And while that is teaching them, and I like the King James better than the NIV in this case, to observe all things I have commanded you. So obey, which is what we see in the NIV, it usually means that you listen to me and you do what I said. Okay? That isn't what Jesus is after here. When you observe, that means you watch what I do and you do what I do. Okay? So when we are trying to teach somebody to be a disciple, you may not set them in the chair and say, this is how it works, and then walk away and expect them to do it. The way this works is you have to walk along beside them and let them see you fall a few times, and they figure, I don't want to do that. And they learn from watching you. Therefore, if you're going to teach, we have to be doing. The purpose was never to build an awesome community for the sake of the community. It was to make a safe community for people to meet Jesus and be made into disciples, and then they go and disciple others. That's what we're supposed to be doing, folks. That's what discipleship is. It's an action. And I want to leave you with three very important realities about this idea of discipleship. You ready? One, once you become a disciple, the only way to fully grow and develop as a disciple is to be involved in making a disciple. So if you are a disciple with no disciple, then you are incomplete. You're like a cookie maker with no dough. What's the point? You can't make any cookies, can you? So if you are a disciple and you signed up to follow and assist in spreading the gospel, then you have to have somewhere to spread the gospel. Therefore, you must have a disciple. And maybe this is the time you go and say, well, so who am I discipling? Now, maybe you're a grandma and the only one you're discipling is that cute little grandkid that just sets your heart all aflutter. That's okay. You're still discipling. Maybe you're a parent. Good luck. Okay, you've got kids that you're going to be discipling. All right? Maybe you are just the person that is your next-door neighbor. Maybe it's somebody else, and maybe it's a coworker. But you've got somebody in your life that you've got your eyes on to say, this person needs a healthy helping of Jesus, and I am going to make them my disciple, and I am going to see if I can teach them how to follow Jesus. You cannot actually be a disciple unless you are discipling somebody else. Now, if anybody says, preacher says, I'm not a Christian, that ain't what I said. I don't get that call. But what I'm telling you, you cannot be a disciple without having somebody to disciple. You'll become stagnant water, stale. Our purpose is to glorify God by meeting people where they are, sharing Jesus with them in a meaningful way, and encouraging them to live in a growing relationship with Him. That is the purpose statement of our church. Do you see discipleship sown all the way through that? Our idea behind the way we built this church and structured this church was that we were going to be all about discipleship. And my fault, I'll take the hit for it. We got a little off track over the past few years. But The leadership is committed to, we're going to put this back on track. Because it's about time we dive into discipleship. You know, I want that moment. I want that moment when I'm in heaven and Jesus calls me up and says, guess what? We're going to pull the curtain open and we're going to let you conduct the people that you taught. Now, I've got some people in my past that scares me half to death, okay? But I want that moment. I want that moment when I get to see all the influence that I got to have all the way through my life. But you know what the thing is? When they put my band together, my band is a small piece because a big piece of my band belongs to this lady named Mrs. Rhodes, who is the lady that first brought me to church. So my band is part of her band. And her band is part of however she became a Christian. And that band is part of another. And we are all one big orchestra composed and put together to glorify God. That is what discipleship is all about. It isn't about learning new facts and new information. That can be cool and fun if you go share it. But discipleship is all about changing people's lives and pointing people to Jesus. And this is the business that we're in. And it's the business that we need to dive into and get back to.